Welcome to the European Space Agency's ESA Explores podcast. You're listening to a special bonus episode to our Time and Space series. In this series, we explored how human spaceflight has grown and changed in Europe throughout history and where we are going next, in conversation with the experts and astronauts who make it happen. I'm Laura Zumühlen, and today's bonus episode marks a special occasion, the 40th anniversary of Spacelab's first flight, the first European-built space laboratory and ESA's first human spaceflight mission. Those of you who followed our podcast since the beginning might have listened to the very first episodes where we explored the early days of European spaceflight and the history of this unique European-built research facility that flew inside NASA's space shuttle. On the 28th of November, 1983, Spacelab was launched from Kennedy Space Center in Florida on board Space Shuttle Columbia. Spacelab 1 conducted over 70 experiments across various fields, laying the foundation for Europe's later Columbus Laboratory on the International Space Station. For the first time, the shuttle carried a crew of six, including German ESA astronaut Ulf Merbold, the first non-American astronaut to fly on the space shuttle. Ulf became ESA's first astronaut in space, and the 10-day Spacelab 1 mission marked ESA's entry into human spaceflight activities. Today, we have the privilege of speaking with Ulf Merbold, reflecting on 40 years of pioneering space exploration. We will delve into his training and experiences during his first of three spaceflight missions, which significantly shaped modern European science and space exploration. Join us as we explore his passion for flying, his unique experiences orbiting with a moonwalker, and gain insights into his vision for space exploration, from Earth's orbit to the moon and beyond. Welcome, Ulf Merbold. I'm very happy to have you here on the podcast today.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. I mean, I spent many years of my life here in ESC. For me, it's always a nice moment to return and look around.
I'm particularly happy to have you here today then and talk to you because there's a big anniversary. We celebrate 40 years since the launch of the Spacelab. And you were a part of the mission at the time. And for those who might not know, could you briefly explain what Spacelab 1 was and what was your role during the mission back in 1983?
Well, okay. It goes back to NASA's decision to terminate the Apollo program and start with a new system, a reusable launcher. At the end, as we all know, they developed the space shuttle, and the Europeans, in other words, as an agency, ESA, received an invitation to contribute. And after a long period of dealings and wheelings, ESA committed itself to make a contribution, and that actually was Spacelab, which is a toolkit containing a number of different elements. They all fit into the cargo bay of the space shuttle and converted the shuttle from a transportation system into a scientific laboratory. And I enjoyed the privilege to become the first non-American ever taken on a NASA spacecraft to space. And that was, of course, the maiden flight of Spacelab in 40 years ago. And of course, this first flight, Spacelab 1, also known as STS-9, an early mission in the shuttle flight program, had the prime objective to test Spacelab in the real space environment. But the other goal was actually to demonstrate to the scientific community in the States, but also in Europe, in the ESA member states, its universal usability for all kinds of research questions. And my function, to come back to your question, was not to fly the shuttle. It was actually to perform experiments. In this particular case, they came from, I don't know, more than a half a dozen scientific disciplines. And that was, of course, also kind of a burden because we all knew that behind every of these 72 experiments, there was a whole team of scientists who had spent several years of their lifetime to make the experiment ready for space. And then in these particular days, the flight time of the shuttle was very limited to 10 days perhaps. And within this very short period of time, we had the responsibility to bring, to acquire data of good quantity and sufficient quality such that the scientists actually could answer the question he had raised with his experiment. So, but in order to get ready, we all spent 5 years training to prepare ourselves for this task.
And you trained a lot here at European institutions or locations, or you spent a lot of time in other countries as well?
Well, at that point in time, ESA had 11 member states, and our training was not really very localized. We went from one university-type laboratory to the next, and usually it took 3 weeks, and I had only the weekends for the family, and then we continued this training tour in the States, because half of the resources for this particular mission was under NASA control, and that, of course, implied that we had to train also in the States. So I went from MIT to other places in California and so on. And it was a decentralized training. The price was actually the family had to pay for it. But I should perhaps come back to Spacelab as a European provided contribution to the shuttle program that had the name STS, Space Transportation System. And in total, Spacelab has flown, as far as I know, 22 times, always in the cargo bay of the shuttle. And it always worked flawlessly. And I think this is the most important aspect to the Spacelab program, because that, of course, is the reason that ESA could build up credibility in terms of quality of hardware, software, and so on, and of course also to, let's say, the soft skills like control center on the ground. During the Spacelab program, the first time in history we had a control center for the experiments, not for the shuttle, in Oberpfaffenhofen in Germany. So NASA at the end was ready to delegate this kind of functions to a control team not under NASA's control. And from my point of view, step by step, the Europeans, represented primarily because of ESA, they gained recognition in the States, and I'm sure without that precursor, we would not have been become invited to build parts of ISS.
And how does it feel for you now when you look back to the start, for 40 years back, and now looking at the development and the more and more European contributions and, yeah, at the point that we are now?
Well, of course, I mean, this is a good question. I would very much enjoy to find someone who buys me a ticket, because I'd like to go to ISS and now look around and find out what is now the present working environment for scientific work in orbit. That would be a dream. Of course, I know it's not realistic, but anyway, that would be very interesting to do it.
To see, yeah. Do you follow a lot all the current missions and the past European missions on the ISS?
Of course, not only the Europeans, also the other flights. But talking about the European missions, it's not only that my younger colleagues, the fellows, so to say, are now the ones who do the work I did 40 years ago. I'm still very interested in the scientific outcome. Mm. And maybe I should mention at that point in time, before I got into the manned spaceflight program, I had already spent 10 years in solid-state physics working in one of the German Max Planck Institutes. So science is really the core of my interest and the essential, so to say.
Did you have a favorite experiment at the time? Do you remember if there was one thing that you particularly liked?
During my flights? Or?
Yes.
That's hard to say. I mean, we had experiments, material science experiments. That was basically lab technician work. So you put one of the samples into one of the furnaces, and then you had to start a computer program, and the rest was primarily controlled by computers. And the real scientific work analyzing the material science samples, for instance, that took place later when the samples were back on the ground and were back in the laboratory of the relevant scientist. But we had also other experiments where we had the full responsibility for the scientific outcome. And many of them were actually human physiology experiments. So a lot of scientific work had to deal with the vestibular organ and the immune system. And that is research where the crew in real time has to take decisions how to continue the research, in which direction to go with the experiment. And of course, that is more interesting than to exchange material science samples.
Mm. And it's also still, I think, a big part of the science they still do on the space station right now, and it's very important.
We had also other things. For instance, we tried to grow single crystals of 3-5 semiconductors or silicon, and to grow, at least in these early days, 40 years ago, to grow a single crystal to a certain degree is more an art than it is science, because you have to, in a way, train. It's almost like playing the violin. You can talk a lot of how it should sound, but at the end, it is something you have to, in a way, it's more a gut feeling to say, okay, it's going well or it's going not too well.
Yeah. Yeah. And you already said you've been the first European, so non-American, on the mission. How would you see the international cooperation back then, and how important do you think it still is?
Well, I think I'd like to start from the present. And I think the ISS, from my point of view, is an icon of cooperation. All the agencies who have experience and know the details of space and its shortcomings and potentials decided to cooperate. And I think what we have in orbit now since 2000 is really remarkable. I think the first module, Zarya, was put up in 1998, as far as I remember. And of course, the scientific potential of then it took about 10 years, and lots of agencies and countries contributed until we had the assembly complete. Now we have a very powerful scientific platform in orbit. Now I, as you already said, trained together with Claude Nicollier and Vubo Ockels as the first European astronauts. We were called payload specialists. And when we came to the Johnson Space Center to Houston, I will never ever forget that Owen Garriott and Bob Parker, two of the professional career astronauts from Johnson Space Center, but came to the training sites with two T-38s. They enjoyed to fly these very nice little jet training airplanes. And then we continued from one laboratory to the next, and they flew the T-38s, but with an empty seat. And I would have liked so badly to take the seat in the back, and because I enjoy flying very much. But one day, I found on my training schedule T-38 flight. I went out to Ellington Air Base, which is not that far away from Johnson, and showed them my training schedule, and finally I got a helmet, parachute, oxygen mask, and now I was waiting. And then for a moment I thought it cannot be real, because there was a little chap moving along, and from the distance I thought looks like John Young, but he was the chief astronaut, and I thought he has other things to do. But sure enough, it was John, and he said, I will give you a $3 ride, which means a roller coaster flight. And we went out flying and over the Gulf and pulled a lot of G's. And after 20 minutes in the air, I asked him whether I could also get some stick time. He raised his hand and demonstrated it's all under your control. And then I could fly the T-38, and I pulled as hard as I could and turns and loops. And for me, that was really the icebreaker. I was part of his crew and his team. And in real flight in orbit, he was extremely supportive. He, Space Lab 1 was the first flight in NASA's history where, when we worked in shifts, so we had a red team and a blue team. And after 12 hours in Space Lab, respectively in the shuttle cockpit, the others came on duty, and I was lucky because I was on John's shift. And when we, Bob Parker and myself, from Space Lab through this tunnel, came back into the mid-deck of the shuttle, he had dinner ready, and he did all this housekeeping stuff in order to allow us to spend our time for more important functions. And it was also very emotional, because then we had an hour with him eating dinner. And during this very social hour, he told us a lot of stories, what happened during his astronaut career, in particular what happened when he was on the moon. He's one of the two NASA astronauts who was sent to the moon twice. And even in retrospect, it appears almost unreal from my perspective that I spent eating every evening with a guy who had worked on the moon. And during this social hour, on top of all that, we basically completed one revolution around our home planet. So it's a total, it's a situation so far away from daily life. And I'm very happy that I had this chance to be with him.
And you talked about the moon already. How do you feel that we might have a European soon, actually, also on the lunar surface?
Yeah, of course. That is, I could say, I was involved in the start of that. Because Space Lab 1 and what came later, I had another shuttle flight also with Space Lab, in a way, from my point of view, is the starting point for what comes now. And of course, it makes me proud that my younger colleagues, fellows, most likely will get this flight or this chance to actually land on the moon. And I hope very much that meanwhile, we have gained additional knowledge. We had lots of time. The last landing was more than 50 years ago to think about it. And I would guess, but I'm confident that that will also enlarge and improve the scientific knowledge. I mean, just go back to the moon. In order to be there and come back, that is a bit too empty. I think there should be also some content to it.
Is there something specific you would wish for, you could imagine, for the next 40 years then maybe of space exploration?
Well, I think for this kind of time frame, it is still a challenge. It's an ambitious goal, but I guess with a lot of determination and will also from the political side, it may be possible to go to Mars within these 40 years now. And I think this is the real challenge to humanity, to all of us. I think the obvious goal from my perspective is actually to explore the solar system. And in more real terms, it's obvious it has to be Mars.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing all your experiences. And do you think that also sharing what you just shared with us and also everybody else in the space community talking and continuing to promote this topic, that this inspires more people? And do you think also that this is important to do this kind of outreach?
Yes, I think so. People, at least, maybe not all, but most of them are curious. And that is the driving reasons why we do research in order to understand the internal systems, how the atmosphere works, and so on. And I think that, and space in particular, is a stimulation for young people when they try to find a way for their lives to go into this kind of very fascinating areas. And of course, whatever you learn in the space business or in space technology or also in science is not at the end relevant for space. Many things we learn improve also technologies we have in a common daily life situation. I mean, I hope very much that many young people take the decision to study this kind of disciplines, air and space, or I don't know, whatever. Also other fields like biology, medicine, and so on. Because whatever they learn helps society to develop or push the experience horizon.
Thank you for listening to ESA Explores. Find out more about Spacelab 1, ESA astronaut Ulf Merbold, and the history of European space exploration on previous episodes of the ESA Explores Time and Space series. You can visit us on the ESA website at esa.int and our official ESA exploration blog at blogs.esa.int. You can also find us on X at ESA Spaceflight using the hashtag ESAExplores to let us know what you think. And if you liked what you hear, don't forget to subscribe and share via your favorite podcast platform so we can reach even more space fans in Europe and beyond. Thank you for listening to ESA Explores.